This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Is sugar in my bowl? And my name's Joyce Jones, and let's start off with the theme.
I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh, so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl. So they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
So that's the theme of Sugar in My Bowl. It's Nina Simone. This particular recording is from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967 and 1972. And this is a Sugar in My Bowl music special. And today, as we'll be having a conversation with Farrah Jasmine Griffin. And my sort of guest co-host today is this evening is Hank Williams. Actually, could you introduce yourselves? Just so we're also going to have Salim Washington on the line as well. But I wanted to play some music first. But maybe you should wait till Salim gets on, and we'll all introduce us, or they'll introduce themselves later. Let's start off with this. Thank you.
Thank you.
right. Now, that was Miles Davis with, Well, I thought I was going to be ready. Well, that was two bass hit. Miles Davis with Cannonball Adderley, John Coltrane. Oops, Cannonball Adderley on alto sax. John Coltrane on tenor. Red Garland on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, Philly Joe Jones on drums. That's who we heard exiting the song. And before that, we heard... let me start opening mics and things. And before that, we heard Salt Peanuts from Steamin' with the Miles Davis Quintet. And that was on Prestige. It's one of the sort of like, what would you call it, Miss Griffin? It was sort of like the...
Which is steaming?
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those CDs that he did with Prestige, the working, cooking, hard bop sessions before moving on to Columbia. So, yeah, where we get to hear him with what we call the greatest jazz collaboration ever. Before the famous Kind of Blue sessions.
Okay. Let's see. And before that, we heard Bye Bye Blackbird. That was from Roundabout Midnight. And let's see on that one. Oh, gosh. We have John Coltrane on tenor. Of course, Miles Davis on trumpet. Red Garland on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and of course Philly Joe Jones. That is the famous quintet, Miles Davis Quintet. And we also have in the studio Hank Williams. Actually, with the two of you, starting with Miss Griffin, if you could introduce yourself.
Surely. I'm Farrah Jasmine Griffin, a fan of Joyce's and a fan and lover of the music. Also, a professor of English and African American Studies at Columbia University, and writer at large, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'm Hank Williams, and I'm a doctoral student in English at the CUNY Graduate Center, and I also teach in the Gallatin School at NYU and the SEEK program up at City College, among with what seems like a million other things. And when we get him on the phone in a couple of minutes, we'll have Professor Salim Washington, who's with the Institute of Studies in American Music at Brooklyn College, and is a co-author of Clawing at the Limits of Cool with Professor Griffin.
And Salim Washington should be on the line right now. Hello.
Hello, hello.
There you are. Okay. Sorry about that.
Hello, Salim.
We were in the process of introductions, so could you introduce yourself, please?
Hello, I'm Salim Washington, and I am co-author with Farrah, and also a saxophonist and a professor of music.
Okay. So let's, I hope you don't mind if I put something on, because it feels like we're in a library right now, and that makes me uncomfortable.
Okay.
Oh, if it becomes a little too much for you, let me know, and I'll, you know, just cut it out. Salim, in particular, because you're on the phone.
Oh, no problem.
Okay. So, let's see. Tell us first how you started, how you decided to do this project. We'll start with Farrah.
Sure. I was actually invited to do the project by Salim. He had been approached by an editor who initially approached another scholar and writer, Robin Kelly. Robin Kelly was hard at work on his forthcoming biography of Monk, and the editor was looking for someone to write something on Miles Davis's Prestige recordings, and Robin suggested Salim, and Salim was very gracious. In agreeing, he requested that I work with him. We had been wanting to work on a project together. And so really, I wish we could say we came up with the idea ourselves, but we did not. It was commissioned, although not commissioned quite in the form that that we ended up writing it.
Saleem, can you talk a little bit about the collaboration process of you two writing the book and possibly the different approaches that you both bring to it?
Yeah, I can. I think the collaboration between Farah and I is one of the highlights of the book. It's definitely improved the book, I think. It started off, I guess what I would say mostly is that it was a process that developed as it went along, and it became more or less seamless. Initially, we had divided up different topics or different sections or different chapters, and once we had worked with them, we would check with the other person to have the other writer look it over and make comments and suggestions. And what eventually happened was that as we were writing it, we were going back and forth with questions and suggestions so that it became really almost like co-writing each and every section together, as well as proofreading and rewriting afterwards, after they were done. And so there's a way in which the collaboration developed over time in terms of the process of writing. Initially, we had thought that perhaps I would have special expertise in musical analysis because I'm a musician. But it turned out that Farah has a very keen ear and a very sophisticated understanding of the music. And she is a practicing writer in a way that is different from me. That is, for instance, I play music, and it's a discipline that involves a daily relationship to it that is somewhat in addition to the professional expression of it. And she is a writer in that sense, and making exercises and daily commitment to it as a way of life, as a process. And so I learned a lot about the similarities between being a musician and being a writer. And so I think that was one of the unexpected benefits of the collaboration process.
And I would say that by the end of the process, you know, Saleem really came into his own voice as a writer. I mean, he's already comfortable with his voice as a musician, but he really, you know, kind of hit his stride as a writer by the end of the process and found a voice that he was comfortable with. And, you know, I would read something and I'd say, oh, wow, you know, your prose is singing today. So it was a learning process for both of us.
Well, I noticed that there were a lot of historical entries. During the period, depending on the recording, it seemed to give a lot to what was happening with each particular artist. Who was responsible for that?
Well, we decided early on together that that was something that was going to be very important to us, that we wanted to write a book. I mean, we'd read all these different kinds of books on jazz, and some of them were purely kind of sociological, and some of them were just going to be purely formal musical analysis. And for us, it was impossible to separate the history from the analysis of the music, because we thought that the music actually told us a lot about the historical period, mm-hmm. and about, you know, about American history, about world history, and about kind of the history of the Black freedom struggle in the United States. And so from the very beginning, we knew that we wanted it to be kind of strongly based in history. Mm. And we decided kind of what those historical parameters were going to be.
Mm. Saleem, is there something you want to add to that?
No, I think that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. That is very timely in the sense that that is what has largely been missing in discussions about our music, is that too often the music is discussed as some type of aesthetic artifact that just hangs in space somehow, mm-hmm. untethered to people or to real events in the world. And I think is it Baraka who says that, you know, some of the most profound statements about Negro life have been made in this music. Mm. And the fact is that the kind of complex and complete information about humanity is contained in this art form in a way that is not contained anywhere else. And so to not try to make that bridge of understanding between events in the real world, social and political and cultural, and the music itself, it impoverishes our understanding of the music. And so I think this is one contribution, hopefully, toward a more complete way of looking at the music.
Well, Farrah, both you and Salim have been mainstays of the jazz study group at Columbia for several years. So it didn't, the interdisciplinary aspect and the approach you take didn't surprise me. But was there anything difficult about the composition process in terms of balancing the musical analysis? It gets quite deep at times with being able to ground it in history and the larger fabric of American culture.
I think that we knew we did not want to kind of short shift the music ever, you know, and that, you know, it would be a real loss to have someone like Salim as writer on this project and not take advantage of his full understanding, both as kind of a student of the music and as a practitioner. So we decided that, you know, if we had to err, we'd err on the side of too much attention to the music rather than too little. And we also decided that we weren't going to, you know, dumb down anything. We were going to assume that our readers were capable of understanding, and that if they sat down with the book and the piece of music that we were talking about, if they didn't know, they could learn, and hope that people would be willing to take that kind of time to do so. So I think that's, you know, that's just the decision that we made early on in terms of how we were going to frame this.
Well, there were parts in the book where, I guess, where Salim would contribute a sort of musical breakdown of what's happening in the music. What is it, modal?
Modal, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I did appreciate your explaining the terminology there.
Okay.
Yeah, I was so glad that he was able to do that, because so often there are terms that people use, mm-hmm. and they'll say, well, you know, that's when Miles was working in modal, you know, there are terms that people use, and then people who are unlikely to ask, well, what exactly does that mean?
Right.
Because you're supposed to know, because
right.
you're supposed to be hip,
right.
you know. And so we just decided we would say everything, and I'd go through sometimes, and, you know, I would just ask the stupid question, like, what does this mean? And then Salim was so good at being able to explain it.
Well, since we mentioned modal, could you explain, Salim, what that is?
Well, modal in this has many meanings, but in the sense that we mean it with Miles Davis and John Coltrane, or in jazz in particular, it means basing your improvisations or basing the composition, but most especially the improvisations, on a set of pitches, a scale, or a mode, we call it, of a scale, rather than a set of chords or harmonic progression. So while bebop was a music that was based upon difficult and complex chord structures, modal music, modal jazz, was based upon much simpler harmonic motion. And so the shift went away from harmony, per se, to melodic invention.
Mm.
And so this opened the door for Coltrane's more mature work.
Right.
He would take this modal ideal even further and infuse it with practices from India, practices from Africa, and so forth, where he gets further and further away from the diatonic, hierarchical thinking of Western art music. And so this is really, I think, an important kind of moment in our music where you see a real shift going from a paradigm that privileges Europe to one that privileges African-American aesthetics.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I think that what I hope will come from the book and people reading the musical analysis in particular the historical narrative sort of provides a thread and gives you something to hold on to, and the personalities, you know, because they're such extraordinary personalities. They're sort of like the characters of the book. But I know that what I'd hoped was that the reader would get out of the musical analysis what I often get out of conversations with musicians, with friends who are musicians. And it's not so much what it is affirming and giving me a way to think about what I've always been hearing, mm-hmm. you know, and I'll take something as simple as chords, you know, until someone really explained to me what was going on with chords. It wasn't that I hadn't already heard that and known that I was being moved by, you know, right. moved by this, but now I had an explanation for it. And I hope that's what the book will do with the musical analysis.
Well, there's one thing, another thing that I noticed, and more or less having to do with how you told their story, mm-hmm. you know, both of them, and it, you know, I found myself rooting for Coltrane. Because you know, it felt like, you know, the underdog, you know, because he had such a, I mean, it was such a, you know, affirming life, you know, just wonderful story, and he was like a phoenix, you know. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about them.
Just a little bit.
And what your aim was in telling their stories.
Well, you know, I'll let Salim, you know, take the lead here. I will say that I came initially to the book with a kind of love of Coltrane, but not really a deep knowledge about him, and that I grew up listening to Miles. Miles was one of my father's favorite musicians. His were the albums that I heard as a child. And develop my own relationship with him and his music, however complex. And Train was someone who, you know, I knew I had to love. But I think that I came to know him through this process. And I think that Salim's relationship was, you know, quite different because he came to this project with already having been converted by Train many, many years ago.
Yeah, that's true. There's a way in which Coltrane's music can be more difficult to love, particularly since he was not the kind of gifted melodic. Well, I mean, he didn't have the kind of prodigious melodic gifts that Miles possessed early on. And Coltrane is a person who had to work his way into his genius. And one of the wonderful things about Coltrane's music is that you have this kind of odyssey if you listen to his recordings. And he becomes more and more confident of his voice, but also more and more complex and even at times somewhat strident. Whereas Miles, as a teenager, was already playing in the greatest band in the world with Charlie Parker. And so there's a way where it's natural to kind of root for the underdog, because Coltrane is kind of like a regular person who just through determination and dedication and talent, certainly, but certainly a lot of hard work and persistence, was able to rise like a phoenix, as you say. He's a person who also had suffered great loss in his personal life and also had a lot of difficulties in his professional life. And so there is a way in which he's an underdog that rises.
Well, it seems like the entry point to Coltrane is often which Coltrane you're talking about and where you actually begin to access him, because the Coltrane that we're talking about here is much different, obviously, than what we'd see even just a few years later, and certainly much, much different from the period at the later point in his career, which you allude to a little bit in the book, where he was savaged by downbeat and all sorts of critics. Where was it that both of you sort of began to approach Coltrane's music? And was it a process where he actually started to grow on you, or did
I loved him at first sound? When I first heard Coltrane on a record, I was a teenager. I couldn't believe it.
Which one was it?
The first thing I heard was him with Miles at live at Newport. And then he had there was another side that called Exotica. Mm-hmm. And so I heard him playing Straight No Chaser and Exotica. And I was a musician. I was a composer. And I did not, believe it or not, know about this music. And I was just astounded. To me, it was more beautiful and more intelligent and more powerful than anything I had ever heard. And it just affected me. It just made me sit down and reevaluate my whole life immediately. I didn't understand it technically, what was going on, but I knew that it was intelligent, and I certainly knew that it was beautiful. And it kind of really made not just a change in me as a musician, but as a person, because his sound was so earnest and so spiritual, and so it just got inside of me, and it made me want to know more. It almost made an evangelist of me, because I used to make all my friends listen to him, you know, because I just couldn't believe everybody should know about this music.
That seems to be a common reaction.
Actually, that's something that I wanted to ask you about, the sort of spirituality that is addressed.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I was just going to talk about, I grew up in Philadelphia, where Coltrane just reigns, supreme. And even without ever hearing his music, you get this, if you're interested in jazz, Train is very significant. So I think even before really listening to him, I knew that he was a figure that I needed to know about. The spirituality piece for us, again, was very important, because it's the piece that we thought was often missing when people talk about, oddly enough, when they talk about so much of black music, and particularly jazz. I mean, it seems like it's completely divorced. And I don't think it's a malicious divorcing. I think it's just a kind of lack of understanding of just how spiritual, not religious, but spiritual this music has been. And it, of course, Coltrane provides you the opportunity to talk about it, because he talked about his music in terms of spirituality, in terms of his own kind of conversion process. But I think for us, it also extended into a discussion of Miles. And it was something that for me had started even in my earlier writings about Billie Holiday, that it was almost impossible to write about these people and this music without attending to the spiritual dimensions of it, even when those people were not as obviously talking about spirituality as Coltrane was.
Yeah. Well, Miles was definitely not talking about spirituality.
Yeah, he doesn't. I mean, there's some quotations. We were able to listen to hours and hours of taped interviews with him. And it's interesting, though, because spirituality comes up for him. And he talks about, first of all, he talks about Train spirituality, even in the depth of Train's own struggles with addiction. Miles talks about him as a spiritual person. And then Miles talks about playing the music as having a spiritual dimension. I mean, he's profane when he says it. I can't, of course, I'm looking at the seven words you must not say on the radio here.
That would eliminate quoting much of Miles.
Right, I cannot quote any of Miles, including the quotation about spirituality. But it was a Miles Davis quotation that made me think about kind of the moment of inspiration and improvisation, where you quote, sort of the musical ancestors as being a spiritual moment. And Miles saw it that way, right? That the music connected him to something outside of and much larger than himself, and spoke it in those words, but just using the profanity to describe it.
But I think you make an important distinction there between religion and spirituality. Mm-hmm. And could you maybe unpack that a little bit more for the listeners?
Certainly. I mean, and Salim should definitely jump in, because I know he has opinions about this as well. Train certainly came up through a family of people who were involved in organized religion, AME ministers, I think, on both sides, both grandparents. Miles does not. But Miles, you know, grew up in a black church setting. But neither one of them were espousing a kind of relationship to organized religion, right? And the hierarchies and the taboos and the strictures of organized religion. And yet, I think they were both more so trained, engaged in music as a spiritual practice, connecting them to something bigger. And for Train, a way of making himself a better person and a way of making the world a better world. And, you know, those things are often what religion is supposed to be about, but all too often, you know, are not. And certainly neither one of them would have been welcomed in many churches at the time when they were probably, you know, their most spiritual. Mm-hmm. Salim?
Yeah, well, you know, Charles Parker says he was a devout musician. And I relate to that a lot because I think that all of the great musicians, certainly within our tradition, are approaching it as a spiritual discipline, or else they could not achieve what they do. And it touches with our African American spirituality in so many ways. You know, the whole notion of in a repository of the wisdom and the actions of the ancestors is something that jazz musicians take very seriously. Mm. You know, not just the Coltranes and the Miles Davises, but the Duke Ellingtons, the Mary Lou Williams, the Coleman Hawkins, all of the seminal figures will always talk about their music in the context of the ancestors. And they are quick, as soon as someone tries to say that, you know, that you are the seminal figure, that somehow you have originated this, they will correct you quickly. That, no, there's a repository that we dip from, and that this is what makes this music. It is the music that is great, not us. We just touch the music. And then there's a way in which the entire pursuit of this music is a spiritual endeavor, because it is one in which almost religious, like devotion to craft and learning, is necessary just to be mediocre, just to be competent, not to be special like the people that we're talking about. And you also have to do it with almost a guarantee that you will be marginalized economically, that you will be marginalized in history. It just so happens that these are two people that were successful in almost any terms that we can put it. But that is more often than not the case. And any person who seriously enters in this realm already knows that and does it anyway, right? And so what is it that makes people feel that this is so important, that they have to literally devote their life and make sacrifices that most people wouldn't make? So if they had done half the work, your average jazz musician, in medicine or law or accounting or something, their futures, the stability of their life would be quite different on average. And yet there's something that's not pecuniary gain that drives these people toward this. And so I think that we have missed out a lot, those of us who comment and analyze this music, by not seeing how important it is across the board, this notion of spiritual devotion to become a great musician. And as soon as your ego gets in the way, then the quality of your improvisation plummets. As soon as you start thinking that I'm cute or I'm great, then you're not so great. Or at least the music that comes from you, that comes through you, I should say, will not be so great.
Well, thank you for that. I have a question with regard to, well, next year is apparently the 50th anniversary of Kind of Blue. And, give me your thoughts on that. Just Kind of Blue, and what do you think?
Kind of Blue is, of course, a wonderful, wonderful, groundbreaking, and important recording. I think it's lionized to the exclusion of other great recordings that these musicians made together. And we go on board as saying that it is not necessarily the greatest collaboration. as far for my money, for the records, there was the one that preceded Kind of Blue, Milestones. Which their ways in understanding it that make it equally important, I think. I always, when I was a young musician, and we used to have musician listening parties where we would sit up and, you know, and just listen to music and just exclaim over it and play them over and over and over again. It was Milestones more than Kind of Blue. Although I think for musicians that are younger than me, Kind of Blue is probably a more important artifact. But then there are the live recordings that they did as well. And it's really a dicey thing to start looking at one particular artifact as opposed to the process, a product as opposed to the process, as being the kind of signal achievement. And so, you know, this happens all the time. You know, it's like Love Supreme. Of course that's important, but there are other recordings that are equally beautiful, equally sublime, you know, that can teach us just as much. And sometimes when we elevate one particular product, it's almost against the whole kind of aesthetic integrity of what jazz is, because jazz is something that is improvised to a large extent. And if we look at a product and lionize it too much, I think we get away from the process side of it, which is what makes it so engrossing for the participants, I think, and for the listeners as well, because listeners are participants. Also,
yeah, I think that Kind of Blue is, it is without question simply beautiful, beautiful work. It is a very, very good entry point, starting point. If you want to introduce anybody to this music, it's a great way to introduce them and invite them in. I think that we live in a culture where we're always making lists, right? The 100 greatest this, the 50 greatest that.
Right.
We're making canons, and what's going to be the... And I think of it as a professor of literature, like which book from the African-American literary tradition is going to make it into the canon? Invisible Man. And there are reasons why. I mean, it's beautiful, it's complex, it speaks to the other works there in ways to people who are not only interested in the experience that's rendered therein. So I think that, you know, Kind of Blue, and also Kind of Blue has this incredible marketing machine behind it. Also, so if next year is an anniversary, believe me, we will all know.
let me say this, too. Flamenco Sketches.
Yes.
From the Kind of Blue
yes.
album, I think is one of the most spiritual utterances ever made.
Yes, it is.
And you know, I won't go into details, but I think that song saved my life.
Mm, okay.
I'm going to testify.
Right? Okay, I'll take your word for it.
Okay.
By the way, there are box sets. There is a box set to come. So
probably a few books, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this one could definitely accompany that celebration. So, Hank, is there something else you wanted to...
Well, to take a step back for a moment, you spend some time in the book going through Milestones, and you seem to see that as somewhat of a fairly crucial turning point in the relationship between Miles and Coltrane. So maybe you could talk about that for our listeners.
Well, Coltrane, for me, this is the beginning of his mature artistry in 57. He was wonderful before in the prestige recordings, but his tone and his virtuosity and the kind of revolutionary import of his ideas come together in a way in 57 that simply, for me, is not present before. His tone before is interesting because it is a unique and hard-edged sound, but it lacks the brilliance and clarity that we hear when he comes to the Milestones recording. And this whole idea of the sheets of sounds and this astounding velocity that Coltrane was able to achieve on the tenor saxophone, this is where we see it first with Miles. And so I think he had already made a personal turning point by being freed from his alcohol and heroin addictions. He had already learned so much from his tenure with Thelonious Monk, and he had dedicated his life and his music to God at this point in a very self-conscious and deliberate way. And I think you can hear all of this when you listen to the recordings that he makes thereafter.
Farrah, looks like there's something you want to read.
No, I was just looking. You know, sometimes when we mention particular songs or albums or recordings, I like to go back and look and see, because, you know, I think one thing about writing a book is that there's a process in writing, too. Mm-hmm. I think it's at the beginning of one of his novels, Baraka has a epigraph where he says, "He who writes this will never read it." That by the time you're done writing something, you're a different person.
Mm.
And so I always go back to see, would we say the same thing about that now? But I think we would certainly say the same thing about milestones. I don't doubt that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, milestones, you know, one of the things that album has is not just the beauty of Coltrane, but it's the beauty of the Miles Davis Sextet.
Mm.
And that's one of the things that we feel strongly about, is that really the people who are in the rhythm section are often neglected and forgotten about. But really, the magic that happens is not possible without their special contributions. And I think that the telepathy that happened between Philly Joe Jones on drums and Red Garland on piano was one of the greatest kind of ensemble phenomenons in the whole history of jazz. And this is part of what made Miles Davis's band so exciting, because Philly Joe, in Miles' word, had that thing. And also, they were able to kind of make a small band almost have the kind of force and presence of a big band, in part because of the figures that Philly Joe and Red Garland were able to play behind the soloists and during the heads. And they not only had the punch and power of the big band licks, but they had an improvised character to it. So it was very supple and hip, you know, and it was something that sounded like it was prearranged in terms of its intricacy and how together it was. But at the same time, it had the lightness and the spontaneity of improvisation. And so it's a delightful thing that makes the brilliance of a John Coltrane or of a Miles Davis stand in bold relief. Not possible without them. And so I think the rhythm section is one of the things that makes Milestones one of my favorite recordings of this group.
Well, I do have to say that you're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. So, Sugar in My Bowl music special. My name's Joyce Jones, and I'm here with my special co-host for this evening, Hank Williams, and Farrah Jasmine Griffin. And on the phone we have Salim Washington, who are the co-authors of Clawing at the Limits of Cool. Okay, let's have the whole title.
The whole controversial title. The whole title is Falling at the Limits of Cool, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and the Greatest Jazz Collaboration Ever.
Yeah.
Which has gotten us into a little bit of trouble.
Really? Now how?
As if she doesn't know, right?
Well,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, it's we chose Clawing at the Limits of Cool from a, it's a line from a poem by Mary Baraka. Baraka is a presence who kind of floats through this book quietly. You know, his influence is very clear. But it's from the poem Amtrak, and we were very happy that the marketing people decided to go with that, even though it's not clear to everyone immediately what it means. Our editor did choose the subtitle, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and the Greatest Jazz Collaboration Ever, and he gave us the opportunity to challenge and change that. We weren't quick enough, but we knew that, you know, diehard lovers of the music like we are, we're out there just waiting to say, how dare you say that was the greatest jazz collaboration ever? What about this? What about that? What about that? You know, and so we agree. We concede that there were other collaborations. And that's one of the reasons also in the beginning of the book, I mean, we talk about the other collaborations that were as good, if not better, at times. But we also, I think what Salim was saying about, we really do stress and emphasize the importance of that rhythm section, and make it clear that for all that this music is about Train and Miles, it couldn't have happened without without these other people and these other figures. I mean, we talk about this being the rhythm section to die for. And of the many things I hope people take away from the book is that I hope they take away listening to the rhythm section. You know, not just listening to these two compelling soloists, but really listening to what's making it possible, what's making it happen. So the greatest collaboration ever is not just Train and Miles, but also the rhythm section.
So you have something you want to share?
I was going to share the rhythm section part. So just a little bit from that. In addition to the front line, Miles' rhythm section was to die for. The propulsion that Paul Chambers gave the band was phenomenal. His tone was clear and resonant, his note choices intelligent, and his swing powerful and steady. As a bassist, he could solo with the kind of phrasing, articulation, and content that horn players use. And if that were not amazing enough, he could pick up his bow and take care of business there as well. And with Philly Joe Jones on drums and Red Garland on piano, the rhythm section became a swinging affair, steady but pliant at the same time. And we go on to talk about just how that rhythm section creates a world in some ways for Miles and Train. I mean, they can't do anything but soar in that context.
Well, you also, based on the different recordings, Milestones and Kind of Blue and Cooking and everything else, you indicate how the rhythm section contributes.
Yeah, they are, you know, they are not in any way minor characters. You know, we try to make sure that they, you know, that the people who maybe had not heard of Paul Chambers, I mean, I think there are few people who haven't heard of Philly Joe Jones or Red Garland, that those were names that will become familiar and part of the pantheon. Yeah.
Well, you just mentioned Baraka a few minutes ago, and I think maybe to bring it back to that, one interesting thing you talked about when we were preparing for the show was that you actually credit both Baraka and Stanley Crouch in the acknowledgments of the book, and the two of them are often, you know, the two are often put at diametrical ends of the spectrum. I was trying to figure out how to vocalize that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's true, and rightly so, you know, that they are. But I think that in our experience in writing this book, both of them were very, very helpful. Baraka, you know, in a very informal conversation that we had with him, just dropped gems on us, and then in his body of work, really did help to inform the framework. You know, I mean, it's one of the reasons why history is so central, one of the reasons why we knew we could talk about the spirituality of the music. And Stanley, I have to say, was very, very generous. We interviewed him, and we didn't interview him about, you know, specifics like, did you know Train, did you know Miles, but just to kind of pick his brain. And he was, you know, very generous with his ideas and his thoughts. And I have to say, this is one way that he certainly influenced the book. He insisted that we be attentive to the fact that both of these men had what he called country roots. And it was when listening to that made us go back and really, you know, push the history part back to look at not just where they came from, not just their parents, but the book actually opens with their grandparents' generation. And it became clear that that generation, just out of slavery, in Reconstruction, building schools, building homes, creating a black middle class, was as important as anything else in shaping who these men became. And I credit that conversation with Stanley Crouch, with having done that for us. I think, you know, Baraka in his writings, and then his just talking to us about Train, you know, over what wasn't even supposed to be an interview with him, just an impromptu conversation that just opened up all kinds of doors. So in this book, they are not as much at odds as we know them to be. And they're both kind of, you know, in some ways, godfathers to the process, I think. Yeah.
Salim, was there something you wanted to add to that?
No, I think she said it perfectly.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I do have a question, and I'm not quite sure. Well, it may not be related to the book itself.
It's okay.
But the book does address the direction that both artists went upon leaving the quintet. And since we were talking about Stanley Crouch, from what I've heard, Stanley Crouch didn't exactly appreciate the direction in which, and a lot of other people apparently didn't appreciate the growth of both artists. What are your thoughts about the growth of both artists?
Yeah. Go on.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Okay. I think that we have to allow, some people, you kind of have a dividing line between people who think that there was no growth, right? Or that there was like a regression.
Yes.
Exactly. A regression. I think it's almost impossible to listen, really listen and buy into the regression line. Now, there can be growth that you don't agree with or growth that you don't like.
Right.
But I think that it's really unfair to try and hold artists back. I mean, the thing that you hope for is that artists will grow, and that and take us somewhere new, you know. And sometimes it's somewhere we go kicking and screaming. It's not where we want to go. I certainly felt that way about Miles. There was a Miles that I grew up loving, who spoke to a particular experience and set of relationships in my life, and I for a long time felt like I couldn't go where he was going. I didn't want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, as people who are participating in the creation of the music with our favorite artists, we owe it to them to allow them to grow and to listen. And they might take us somewhere expansive. And certainly that's what Train did. So I would fall on the side of grow, listen, see if you can go there. And I don't think either of them regressed.
No.
You know, and certainly, I actually think Miles changed a lot less than people claim he did. The settings around him changed.
That was my feeling
you
as
know?
Well.
But Miles didn't really, you know, he sounds like Miles.
Right.
All
right,
the time. But
right.
Salim, I know you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I was just going to, the only thing I would add to that is that it's ironic that that so many people didn't want these two artists to go in the directions that they did, because part of why we love them is that they were not safe, and that they were pushing things.
Mm-hmm.
And then to finally get to where we understand where they pushed things to, and then say, okay, now stop pushing, is really kind of ironic to me.
Yeah.
You know, because the whatever stage that they were at that we do agree with, they got there, through changing things. It wasn't something that they received intact in the way that we hear it. And so the other thing I would say is that part of why we venerate these artists is because they're supposed to teach us something, not just be an entertainer in the sense of playing what we want to hear, but to play what we need to hear, or to play what the times demand. And so if they don't do that, then they are something other than the artist that we celebrate.
And I think part of that growth process, too, I mean, you know, is taking risk.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you take risk, you risk failing. You know? And that you make a mistake, or, you know, that something doesn't quite work. And that the measure of the artistry is, do you keep trying? You know, and what do you learn from that failure? What do you learn from that mistake? What do you turn it into? And I certainly, you know, as I look to try to figure out ways to model my own intellectual work and growth, you know, I want to be allowed the opportunity to fail, you know, to mess up sometimes. You know,
right.
It's worth the risk. You learn more. I think you learn more from the mistakes than from the safety.
Now, who defines the mistakes, though?
Right, right. Who defines them as mistakes?
That's the other question.
Right? Absolutely. Because Train, you know, people were defining his work as mistakes all the time, you know, over and over again.
But I think sometimes it also creates different access points to the music that might not ordinarily exist. And Farah, it's interesting that you noted where you got into Miles. And I mean, my first encounter with Miles was some of the stuff that he was almost universally loathed for. Human nature, and yeah. Time after time on You're Under Arrest and
wow.
Decoy. And I actually went back from that through the 70s stuff that he's, you know, almost equally loathed for. Pangea, Agarda, A Tribute to Jack Johnson, which I think is just one of the most brilliant, really one of the most brilliant things I'd ever heard at the point. So for me, this what you're talking about here actually came relatively recently, and it was only after going through all of that I actually had to go back through Miles's work and get to Kind of Blue and some of the other earlier production.
See, then I would say thank God for that music, because
right.
it's what brought
that's
you
what I
to
say
him.
Every
right?
day.
Exactly. You know, it's it's what brings you. I mean, that the music is speaking to someone all the time.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think about. I'm so glad, for instance, that Cassandra Wilson did a tribute to Miles, because there'll be people who get to that music because of Cassandra, who
right.
never would have done it before. You know. Because of a lyric, because of whatever, you know. So it did what it was supposed to do. It brought you there. Yeah.
Salim?
Yeah, as Hank was talking, I'm reminded of a kind of jazz fascism that I participated in as well. Is that, you know, I grew up listening to gospel music and soul music, funk, R&B. And at a time when R&B musicians were quite virtuosic. So like listening to the Isley Brothers or Earth, Wind & Fire or Stevie Wonder or Kool & the Gang, people like this, was not what a lot of people would call mainstream jazz. But there's so many listeners in my generation that came to mainstream jazz because they listened to those albums and those musicians. And it's so interesting that so many of us, once we discovered the Coltranes and the Miles Davises, started to look down our noses at the music that prepared us to be able to hear it and to dig it. And it's interesting. Now, later in life, I'm beginning to listen to those commercial albums again with the newfound appreciation.
Right.
You know, that really it's hard to just really look at something and say, this is inferior to that. You know, music serves different purposes at different times for different people. And, you know, thank you, as Vera says, thank God for it.
Well, I guess we're going to wrap it up. And I'd like to thank you both, Farah Jasmine Griffin and Salim Washington and Hank Williams, for joining us. Is there anything you want to, some closing words you want to
Well, first,
share?
I just want to thank you for giving us this opportunity and, you know, being so generous with the time. And I think this is the most time we've had to talk about someone other than each other. So,
that's a shame.
So thank you both. Thank you both. It's been very enjoyable. And I would just hope that, you know, your listeners just, you know, keep listening to you and listen to some of this music and maybe give some of the music that they have dismissed or thought as too difficult, too challenging, a chance. You know, use this little break we have coming up, you know, instead of going out and spending a lot of money, to sit home and listen to some good music and think about it. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Salim?
I concur. Thank you.
Thank you. Hank?
Joyce, thank you very much. And thank you, Professor Griffin and Washington.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, everybody. And we'll go out on, what are we going out on? I know, this is from Jazz at the Plaza, Miles Davis Sextet, Volume 1, Olio. And yeah, let's do that. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, Sugar in My Bowl. Stay tuned. Once again, Miles Davis Sextet. From Jazz at the Plaza. That was Oleo. And so I wanted to play some. Yeah, I might as well just call it Christmas music because that's pretty much what it is. There's no major other holidays going on in this music, and so. So I'm going to start off with one of my favorites, Vince Guaraldi, Charlie Brown Christmas. It's like the season hasn't started until I've heard something from this or have seen the special. So even though I have it, you know, I have it in my collection. It's just, you know, I just, anyway. So this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, Sugar in My Bowl. Once again, I'd like to thank... Farah Jasmine Griffin and Salim Washington and my special guest host, Hank Williams, who, by the way, has more Dolphy than Kazembe Balogun. Thank you.
awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa baby, a 54 convertible to light blue. I'll wait up for you, dear Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Think of all the fun I've missed. Think of all the fellas that I haven't kissed. Next year I could be just as good if you check off my Christmas list. Santa baby, I want a yacht, and really that's not a lot. Been an angel all year, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa honey, one little thing I really need, the deed to a platinum mine, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa cutie, and fill my stocking with a duplex and checks. Sign your X on the line, Santa cutie, and hurry down the chimney tonight. Come and trim my Christmas tree with some decorations bought at Tiffany. I really do believe in you. Let's see if you believe in me. Santa baby, forgot to mention one little thing, a ring. I don't mean on the phone, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Hurry down the chimney tonight. Hurry. Tonight.
Okay, that was Eartha Kitt, those who don't know, and the Henri René, and with Henri René and his orchestra, Santa Baby. And before that, we heard the Vince Guaraldi Trio, and that was My Little Drum. From A Charlie Brown Christmas. And let's see, if you want to give me a call, you can give me a call at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. Slow it down, 212-209-2900. And what I'm going to play next is a personal favorite, Diane Reeves, doing a Vince Guaraldi tune. Stay tuned.
Christmas time is here. Happiness and cheer, fun for all that children call their favorite time of year. Snowflakes in the air, carols everywhere, olden times and ancient rhymes of love and dreams to share. Sleigh bells in the air, such spirit through the year.
But for me, it's blue, blue Christmas. That's the way you see it when you're feeling blue, blue Xmas. When you're blue at Christmas time, you see right through all the waste, all the sham, all the haste, and plain old bad taste. Sidewalk Santa Clauses are much, much, much too thin. They're wearing fancy rented costumes, false beards, and big fat phony grins. And nearly everybody's standing around holding out their empty hand or tin cup. Gimme, 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 fill my stocking up, all the way up. It's a time when the greedy give a dime to the needy. Blue Christmas. All the paper tinsel and the fal-de-ral, blue Xmas. People trading gifts that matter not at all, what I call fal-de-ral, bitter gall. Fal-de-ral. Lots of hungry homeless children in your own backyards, while you're very, very busy addressing 20 zillion Christmas cards. Now Yuletide is the season to receive, and oh to give, and ah to share. But all you December do-gooders rush around and rant and rave and loudly blare, Merry Christmas. I hope yours is a bright one, but for me it's
Still are listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. This is a Sugar in My Bowl music special. The first half, or first three quarters, a big chunk of the program was devoted to a discussion about a book, Clawing at the Limits of Cool, co-authored by Farah Jasmine Griffin and Salim Washington. And there was a discussion with them, and 'twas I and my co-host, Henry Hank Williams. That was a lot of fun. And you can find Clawing at the Limits of Cool in your local place where you get your books. And, that's a good thing. It's a very good thing. It's a little too loud. We're listening to Dexter Gordon in the background. I got this from a compilation, Jingle Bell Jazz. I think it's kind of cool. I actually like this season for this music. It's just really cool stuff. So what we're listening to, like I said, is Dexter Gordon Quartet. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. It's Dexter Gordon on tenor sax, Kirk Leitze on acoustic piano, David Eubanks on acoustic bass, Eddie Gladden on drums. And before that, we heard from another compilation, Jazz to the World, John McLaughlin, O Come, Emmanuel. That's beautiful. I like that a lot. That man can play. He can just play, I tell you. And let's see if we have any of his accompaniments. Well, his other cohorts on this recording. Ah, they do. Yippee! That's not a lot to tell. Well, yeah, there's Ben Porosky on cymbals. Jim Beard is apparently on all the other instruments, but John McLaughlin is on guitar. And this is from Jazz to the World. Another Blue Note compilation, yes. Jingle Bell Jazz is on Blue Note as well. You can still find it. It's still around. It's a cute thing. This that we're listening to right now, before John McLaughlin, we heard Miles Davis, Blue Christmas, To Whom It May Concern. And Miles Davis on trumpet, Paul Chambers on bass, Jimmy Cobb on drums, Frank Rehak on trombone, and Wayne Shorter on saxophone, William Correa on percussion, congas and bongos, and that was Bob DeRoe on vocals. Yeah, I always get a kick out of hearing him do his thing. But That was Miles Davis. It was recorded in August 1962, and that is also from the compilation Jingle Bell Jazz, which this Dexter Gordon cut is from. Before that, we heard Rotary Connection, Minnie Riperton, lead vocals. I'm Rotary Connection, singing Silent Night. I love that song! I do. I listen to that any time of the year. Don't care. Because it's just so... And it's a Charles Stepney production. What more should I say? So we have a couple more minutes. And get ready for the... we'll get ready for a rebroadcast of the evening news. And whoever was trying to call me could try me again once I turn off this mic. 212-209-2900. And I'll be able to chat it up with you for a bit. And probably during a little bit of the rebroadcast of the news, but then I got to go, because I got to go to work tomorrow. Yep, got a day job. Got to pay those bills. Yeah, so that's 212-209-2900. And we'll listen to the rest of Dexter Gordon, and listen to, let's see, I think I'll play Etta James next. This is WBAI in New York. Sugar in my bowl. Joyce Jones is my name. Stay tuned. I should be realistic, because I got to get out of here in a couple of minutes. But if you want to contact me off the air, you can write me, Joyce Jones, in care of WBAI, 120 Wall Street, 10th floor, New York, New York, 100. Oh, this is bad. It's bad. I ought to know this in my sleep. But if you have email, that I can tell you, you can contact me at sugarinmybowl@gmail.com. That's sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, at gmail.com. So, in about a minute, we'll listen to some announcements on behalf of this good place. And by the way, thank you to all who contributed your funds to help this valuable WBAI institution to continue. Thank you very much for pitching in, doing your thing, doing your part. We could always use your assistance. I understand we'll be doing this again in January, and so we could use your assistance some more. And like I said, I'll be in the studio for a little bit, so if you want to catch me over the phone, it's 212-209-2900, once the evening news starts. Stay tuned. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
Why are you so sad? It's almost time for Christmas.
My family doesn't celebrate Christmas.
Oh, Jewish?
Uh-uh.
Muslim?
Uh-uh.
Buddhist?
Nope, my family doesn't practice any religion, and we don't believe in things that are supernatural.
But haven't they heard? There are many ways to enjoy and celebrate Christmas that are completely naturalistic.
Really?
Really! And this Christmas, they can learn all about having a perfectly wonderful, naturalistic Christmas on Equal Time for Free Thoughts Naturalistic Christmas Special.
Naturalistic Christmas Special?
That's right!
When?
From 3 to 5 on Christmas Day.
3 to 5 Christmas Day!
Right here on 99.5 WBAI.
It's 2008.
There are no shortcuts.
Are you kidding me?
Fire department came to our door and said, you better get out now.
I think when people review what's taken place in the last 6 months, and put it all in they'll realize how significantly we have moved.
Really?
With the cracking and the thumps and it hit my car.
Oh, my God.
The carnage left more than 170 people.
Accused of masterminding a $15 million Ponzi scheme made up with release on bail with certain conditions.
Mastermind of the Mumbai tax, according to
him. Oh, my God.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are tonight's entertainment.
I only have one question.
Who throws a shoe? Honestly.
Heads up!
It's 2008.
Heads up!
Shortcuts.
Give another one.
Shortcuts. And another one. 2 a.m. 11 p.m. New Year's Eve. Right here on WBAI FM. Shortcuts.
Fidel Castro del Oriente. Abatiza con Mateo.
Casa de las Américas y la coalición Julio 26 les invita a la celebración del 50 aniversario de la Revolución Cubana, el 31 de diciembre de 8 a 2 de la mañana. Este evento se llevará a cabo en el Crystal Room en los Taino Towers, piso 4. Esto queda en el 240 este de la 123, entre Segunda y Tercera Avenida. Para información de boletos, favor de llamar al 347-371-9724. Libertad para los cinco patriotas cubanos.
Casa Las Américas and the July 26th Coalition invite you to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution. New Year's Eve celebration December 31st. Proceeds will go to the Cuban Relief Fund. Celebration located at the Crystal Room of Daino Towers on the fourth floor, located at 240 East 123rd Street. For further ticket information, you can call 347-371-9724. Come and celebrate with food, drink, and dance, international speakers, and the special invited guest, the Cuban ambassador to the United Nations. Free the Cuban Five.
Holiday Bash 09. Celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution. Join the Answer Coalition for a night of music and dancing as they celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution, a revolution that continues to inspire people's movements around the world. Come celebrate on Saturday, January 3rd, 2009. Festivities begin at 9 p.m. at 2005 Amsterdam Avenue on 159th Street in Washington Heights. For more information, call the Answer Coalition at 212-694-8720. That's 212-694-8720.
Children, this is Reverend Billy from the Church of Stop Shopping. You're listening to WBAI FM 99.5, New York City. It's listener-sponsored, children. It's commercial-free. Change-a-looyah.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive. Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.